Greetings all, welcome back to the Powerhouse Perspective, empowering leaders for business breakthroughs. I'm Scott Medeiros, the president of HelmWise, and my partner in crime is always Mr. Chandler Rose, the CEO of the Rosewood family of companies. And if you're new to our podcast, we kind of use a sea metaphor. And what we mean by a sea metaphor is that think about the ocean or the sea. It's unpredictable. So for us, that's the business landscape. That's the business environment. It's constantly changing. You know, they don't know what you're going to get on any given day. Changes with, you know, currents, and it changes with weather and those things that we can't control. But if you are attentive to the environment, if you're a good, knowledgeable sailor, you can start to detect certain principles and patterns. So for us, the sea is our business environment. And on that sea, of course, is a ship, which is your business, your SS Enterprise, if you want to call it that. On your ship, in order to keep it functioning, you need a crew. Those are your employees. And of course, at the helm of the ship is the captain. That's the business leader, whether it's the CEO or the business owner, if you're a small business, but the person who's really there to chart the course for that ship to get it to its safe destination. So we've always talked about how, and actually we've talked about the importance of the ship and making sure that we have good policies and procedures. And on our last podcast, we talked about the crew. How do you select your crew and how do you equip your crew for the journey that the ship is going to go on? But important to all of that, of course, is the topic of communication. So it's important for the leader, it's important for the crew, and more importantly, how does the leader get their vision embedded into the minds of the crew to keep them motivated on a journey which may be very long in its duration? So today in this podcast, we're going to talk about communication. So Chandler, starting with communication, obviously we do it a lot here. For you, what are maybe some of the top two or three areas where communication is very, very important?
First, for sure, is culture.
Culture.
So how do they know where they're working, the environment we want? How do they know what's going on in the business? And so culture is really, you've got to repeat it until you feel nauseous. So it's been written in a lot of books. You probably can name more of them than I can, but it is certainly true. When we started out, we bought a company out of bankruptcy. They had been in Chapter 11, so the employees had been dispersed across the U.S. mainly, some in Mexico, some in Canada. They had been through a bankruptcy, and how do you rally that group of employees around a common culture and a common business? And it is through just bombardment of every type of communication you can come up with. And so you've got to constantly repeat your values, repeat the culture, repeat the expectations, repeat what makes us unique in the business. Again, until it almost makes you nauseous. They say seven times. I don't think that's nearly enough.
Yeah, exactly.
I wish that was true, but with natural attrition in a business, you not being able to get everyone united unless you have a small business or maybe a place where it's one manufacturing facility or a way to get them grouped together, that's going to be seven times seven times seven, and you're going to repeat the same story over and over again and feel like you can't remember who you spoke to last and did I already say this to Scott or did I not? Mm-hmm. And so it's repetition is the name of the game. Consistency of communication. Of course, we're not going to get into it today, but you've got to back it up with the actions. But that starts with laying out the expectations, and the only way to do that to me is through good communication.
Well, your experience with ProVantage, starting out as the core company for the Rosewood family of companies, probably gives us a good example of communication in its various forms. Because I can imagine that when you're first there, like you said, they took the company out of bankruptcy. So there's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of doubt, perhaps, in the crew. You're the new captain coming on board to take this ship to its new destination. Was it a combination of face-to-face and some sort of broadcast? How did you actually establish your initial communication with your new employees?
Well, for the young people, they won't remember 2008. There was no smartphone. We were
no
still on BlackBerries.
Yes.
So,
yes.
I was a 29-year-old, punk at that point, taking over a company that had been around over 15 years. And so a lot of senior people in the company, how do you rally them behind a young person? I was also a practicing attorney at the time. So I had to lean back to what my family does and what I grew up doing, because ProVantage is a more blue-collar workforce, mm-hmm. for sure. So I grew up doing plumbing, commercial plumbing, large projects. So I have familiarity with. So you have to tell that story. You have to tell why they should buy in. But on the road, in person, traveling. As I may have mentioned on this podcast before, my wife and I, we bought the company in July with my mom and I actually. I got married in December, and we went on the road Monday. So Saturday, wedding, Monday out, and then honeymooned about 4 years later. So, you know, there was not any way to even do video conferencing. So you were on calls trying to do, you know, company-wide all-hands calls, calls with leadership teams, calls with leaders in the field. And it's just constantly traveling, trying to meet as many groups and as many influencers within your own organization as you can in person. Tell your personal story, tell your vision of where you want the business to go, tell your expectations, make sure you explain what makes us unique and our strategy to go forward. And then tell them, break that down, as we've talked about here before, into how their everyday job builds into what right. we're trying to produce as a company as a whole.
Right.
And so, and then the biggest thing we did there as well is, you know, we rolled up our sleeves and we set Walmarts and worked on projects. And so they need to know that you're not just talking to them. They need to see that you're going to actually do something with them. So the only way you can do that, obviously, is to be in person, on site, and occasionally drop in. So, and drop in literally beside them and do some work.
And we experienced the same thing in the military. You spent yeah. a lot of time face to face, right? Back in the 80s when I was in the military, 80s and 90s, right? We didn't have cell phones or any of the fancy gadgets that we have today. It came down to truly looking that Marine in the eye, making that connection, and establishing that trust at that particular point. In the Marine Corps, of course, we were big on routine. And so every morning we would arrive, go out for some PT, some physical training, and then have meetings or squad briefings thereafter. And I assume that on the road, you did the same sort of thing. We talked about the importance, I think, on a previous podcast about the shift meeting and how you get everyone together and kind of line out the process or the priorities for the day. So have you found that transition here into the corporate world? So now we have a family of companies, that importance of that routine of getting together daily.
How I think it's
it ebbed and flowed over the growth of the Rosewood family of companies.
Sure. I think we have discounted the importance of it as you move up into the more white collar office jobs. In reality, I would argue it's no different. I think that it actually hurts us. You know, I, for one, and most of the leadership team, they want to just get to work. And that's a little, actually very similar to the field. That's what they said in the field when we started doing shift meetings is, well, you're slowing up our ability to just get to work. We want to hit the floor at 7,
right? Yeah.
Go right to the, you know, what we're working on and start working. And the reality is you lose so much efficiency and cohesiveness by doing that. So we don't start right with jumping into the task of the day. We actually start usually with one of those values that makes us unique. We then go through in the past what we called a 2-minute news. So in our initial company, the teams are dispersed. And so they may feel like a Walmart or a Lowe's or whatever the retailer, up to 30-some there, retailer they're working is, that's their job. And so the 2-minute news was meant to say, well, we finished a Harbor Freight Tools, a Joann's, a Michael's, a container store, you know, in Texas or in Nevada or wherever it is. And so that allowed them to get a 2-minute snapshot of, you know, some highlights of a good employee who's done something well, recognition, highlight of something that's completed or kicked off so that they know the other things. So they feel like they're part of a bigger organization than the group that's just on site. So you do that to let them know that it's a bigger company and there's opportunities to grow and to go other places. You also do that, to be honest, because you want to hedge against, you know, every team is not led the way you want it led. And so by making sure it's clear that there is an organization that's larger than your experience on the ground. You know, so I'm sure it's identical when you're in the Marines, you start breaking it down. It's kind of when, who do they roll up to? And what does the actual organization stand for? Because this team and this individual may not be hitting the mark. And so we don't want the employee to think that is the sole representation. It certainly is the representation of your organization, but it's not all-encompassing of what we're trying to achieve. It may be an anomaly, and if you want to explain to them this is not acceptable and not how we run, they have to know there's a bigger group and a bigger organization and a bigger vision. So we spend the first part of that little 15-minute meeting explaining those things. Like I said, an intro on a value usually or on something in culture, and then we do the 2-minute news, and then we go into, you know, game plan for the day, game plan where we stand for the week, where we stand for the month or the months, depending on how big the project is. So they know where they are and where we need to be. And then I tell our people, which, you know, we're not going to get into that as much today, the, you know, the more complex or the more confused your team may be, the smaller the chunks you create. So instead of giving them where we want to be at the end of the day, you may say, I want it by break or
right,
I want it by
right,
lunch.
Right.
And that helps the team have clear focus. You then go around and do one-on-one walks while the project's going on. And then we always did a fallback. So when Meredith, my wife, and I traveled, she would kind of fall behind me. I would hit the, you know, the seemingly more serious, although she would be taking the data that was important to me. She would go interview new hires, younger employees. You know, how's it going? How does this feel? We talked about our culture. We talked about our values. You understand your pay, your per diem, the policies
right.
here.
Right.
And she would just go around, you know, notepad, but not anything formal, have a conversation, collect information, which then we would, you know, debrief the team on. Afterwards, talk to that lead potentially or talk to the overall. You know, it may not be the lead themselves. It may be the way the lead calls that are explaining to the teams that are in the field. So mm-hmm. we've got to do some of that verification. And we found an informal conversation was better. We still do a lot of calls here that are regimented, so more on your schedule, following up after they've been hired a while.
Right.
You know, how's this going? But you need someone falling back behind you to see if your message is actually being disseminated or if it's being understood or if it's, you know, clearly where you want to be.
Well, I think one of the challenges that you faced with the Rosewood family of companies initially with ProVantage, most enterprises are together, right? They're in an office building. They show up every day. Even if you're a local plumbing contractor or an electrician, your crew usually gathers in some central location and then they disperse into the local area to do their work. And so the communication and establishing the rituals and the routines are a bit easier because everyone is there and you get this ebb and flow of the way that business works from day to day and week to week. You were challenged with the fact that you had people dispersed all across the United States. You had crews in different locales all across the country. And I think at one time in Canada and Mexico as well.
Right.
But yet you've got a very, very small leadership team. You've got a new team. And so the ability to communicate beyond the central location, beyond the corporate headquarters, became, I would assume, especially back in that day with those technologies, a challenge because you didn't have a Chandler Rose at every little location. In fact, you had a lot of people who perhaps hadn't even met you face to face, at least not initially. And so can you give us a little appreciation for how you slowly began to build out the culture, right? Because the repetition you talked about is great, but how did you connect with those people who were remote to you? Did you wait to go and travel to them? Or was there some way in which you disseminated information that reached them and started to build them into the new culture?
Well, I mean, of course you want to establish, we pretty quickly wanted to find who was influential in the field. And so buying a company that had been around over 15 years, I went around to the jobs that were the bigger jobs with as most, you know, most people we'd have in one place was probably 25 people. And so you would see not necessarily who was already in charge, but who did they go to when there was a problem or a conflict or things like that. So we raised several people up, some great older leaders from the previous company that I went to lunch with and kind of established they've got to be your ambassadors in the field. We also did emails daily. We did newsletters monthly. We launched a corporate university program very early on with the help of Campbell University that we do Leadership Live with. So you know, we've got to hit it from every possible angle and
right.
imagination, random recognition programs to where you are, you know, citing people, not necessarily because they got the best score. You certainly want to reward the ones that perform the best, but when, you know, recognition, we try to target towards when they exhibit an action that reflects our values. So they may not be the best person on the team. They may be the one that helps some lady load her cart and, you know, her groceries into a car or, you know, picked up some trash that was behind something no one would have ever noticed. So they're living out the values and the culture. You want to spot that, recognize it, and then find a way to give some recognition. So that could all be done. It just had to be done through the mail, through the phone.
Right.
And we did have, of course, email. So email was there, but email was to computers So
true.
Email was a, when they got back home, did they have a device at the hotel? You know, internet was very spotty. Some of the retailers had it installed. Even the internet there was pretty spotty as well at that point. So we forget. And from 2008 to here, 16 years, we have changed dramatically to the day now of Starlink that is, you know, pretty much everywhere if you want to have it. So between cellular and Starlink and things like that, you know, we pretty much get upset if we lose connectivity at all. You know, we were excited to, we would tell the leads if they had to update information, they could go to a McDonald's, a Starbucks, their hotel. They would have to find a hotspot to actually go hook up.
Wow.
So,
wow. What a challenge.
It was a different world. So it is a little, yeah, little 16 easier.
16 years ago.
But, you know, I think now there's a whole different problem. So now you have the inverted problem of the bombardment of information. So now you have to get your employees' attention.
Right.
And so, you know, it was unique to be able to reach out back then, even though it was a pain to do it. And you had to go kind of a, you know, what people would think is archaic way now.
Right.
But now they have so much distraction. So I think you kind of have another problem of, you know, you want them to jump on a call. In a hotel room, they had the local channels, and if they had enough money to buy a movie, that was it. There was really nothing else for them to do. So it was actually pretty easy to, hey, we're going to have all hands call.
Right, get their attention.
Yeah,
get
well, them now they're, of course, doing TikTok and YouTube and whatever else they're doing. And, you know, and while you're trying to communicate, you can't see them in person. Who knows what's going on? And the same happens to us, obviously. It's so easy to get distracted with a text, a notification, or, you know, whatever pings your phone that's in your pocket. So it's a different set of challenges now for sure, but the platforms are much easier. So.
And as you were talking, and I was thinking in my mind about all the different types of meetings and things that go along, you read different books and people will say you should have your weekly tactical meeting and your monthly strategic meeting and all these types of meetings. Which, in a more structured corporate enterprise, those things start to play, and perhaps we'll talk about that in a few minutes. But still staying with what you've experienced at ProVantage, you know, I've kind of boiled it down through all of my reading into four types of meetings. The first type of meeting is an informational meeting. The reason that you're getting together is to pass information. It's usually kind of a one-way conversation. The person who has the information is disseminating it verbally or in some other mechanism out to the audience. So that sounds like that was at your meeting in the morning, that when you brought people together and you started having the communication about the two-minute news and things of that nature, it was more informational, kind of getting people primed. Then you've got the next type of meeting, which to me is an alignment meeting. So the reason that you're holding the communication or you're coming together is to get everyone aligned. And that requires a little bit of two-way communication. You're going to feed some information. Someone may not get it. They may ask a question. They may see things a little bit differently. But the whole purpose of the communication is to get people aligned so that everyone knows what they're doing collectively. And we know that the left hand is speaking well to the right hand. And it sounds as if that was happening a little bit when you had those senior leaders that you were finding. You call them influencers, right? You're getting them aligned. So that when you weren't there, they were indeed delivering the same aligned message, the same aligned cultural parameters that you wanted them to do, even you, though you couldn't be there personally. Then the next two types of meetings that I, you know, have discerned through all of my reading is a decision meeting. So you're there to actually make a decision. You're probably going to evaluate some options, but the whole purpose that you're meeting is to leave there with a defined outcome, a next step, a direction, something where the options were evaluated, they were decided upon, and then you're going to leave there together now, again, aligned, but with a very specific reason. And then the final meeting is a brainstorming meeting. You're just coming together because you need creative ideas. It may you go all kinds of different directions. You may not know how to do things for the first time. I'm sure that when you were launching ProVantage, you ran across things in stores like, I don't know, and you probably gathered together some of your senior leaders or those who had more experience or been tenured and say, what do you think? How do we do this? How do we solve this? What's the best way of doing this? That to me is a more of a brainstorming meeting. So did you see those four types as you were going through it? You probably didn't recognize them as that, but, or can you think of another type of meeting perhaps I didn't mention? So I had informational, alignment, decision, and brainstorming. I see those as the four key types of meetings or reasons to gather together with a group of people?
Sure. I think we tried to bundle probably three of these into the shift meetings. And so we started with information. To your point, a lot of times we would ask them to have other members of the team read the 2-minute news and sort of spread that out. And then as we aligned on the task, we would ask them to align, like I said, on the day, the month, the week, the month, where we stand. And then have some decisions made in that meeting of talk to the sub teams if it's a large enough, project to, hey, you handle this, what's going on this area, this department, this part of the project, and have that decision there and then break to your point. So not a lot of brainstorming, maybe a tiny bit when they're, bringing up a problem, trying to resolve it. But most of the time we wanted to condense that meeting to no more than 15 minutes. So if it was a true brainstorming, we would, break the team, pull the other leaders together and have a conversation. So I don't want that to happen in there. As far as brainstorming, getting information, I knew nothing about merchandising. So I knew that I'd run blue-collar employees on large projects since I was a teenager. Certainly, being owner-owned law practice, so I'd done from digging ditches to, running a little more complex projects. So familiar there, but as far as the actual task, 100% dependent on leadership that came over from the previous company, at the corporate business level, and then leadership in the field, so establishing good trust. But I did understand what it took among that demographic to treat them like a professional, how you could get them to look like a professional. I understood the perception of the client and how to affect that and impact that. So we worked on that pretty quickly with dress codes, holding the meetings, inviting the clients to some of the meetings at least once a week so that they could, give their advice on what they think. The way we moved on a project, what we called fit and finish, which was, try to go a small thing, but go above the standard of what is required and make sure that everything looks perfectly neat and tidy. Certainly that is a big part of the military as well, of why they require you to fold your sheets and your uniform and your, there is a ton of psychology and good reason for the, we love shabby today and we think that is cool and hoods and sweatshirts. And certainly I would prefer to be in some type of beach attire than even, Scott's trying his best to get me in a jacket always.
Right.
But, when it comes to your work, I used to tell folks that if you finish your work extremely well, the odds of them making sure the big things behind it are done properly go up dramatically, along with the fact that you don't invite near the amount of scrutiny out of your client or an inspector, whoever you're doing business for, providing services to. When you finish it neatly and very tightly and it's presented properly, they assume you've got your stuff together. And the odd thing is, most of the time, if you hold your people and yourself to that level, they will actually have their stuff together because they start taking pride in their work and they go, well, if I'm going to make sure every bottle in the whole paint department and can or restack all the tile in the Lowe's tile department, so that you can read it either walking from the front to the back or straight on, all of a sudden they start making sure, well, if I'm going to do that, the labels are right and the placement is right. And they start understanding the detail was actually. So, we see a lot of the inverse. We even battle that still today of people want to tell you the hard part of the work, which is the hard part, is, the bulk, the getting it done, the building it out. And at the end of the day, the only thing that someone sees is how it finishes.
It's true.
And so we have this misconception that I busted my butt for, weeks or months and I'm finally done here, just take it. It's like, you really missed it. And so Matt Epps used to be our group president, used to love saying a good catch and a bad throw. And that is 100% accurate. So if you do great work, you build the nicest house. We have a company that does custom home building and you don't finish the project well, they don't care how well you framed it or how well your rough end of electrical or plumbing, or they don't care about any of that. Did you trim it well? Did you finish the floors? Did you get it painted? Did you get all the hardware and everything done to trim and finish the house out? And did you get a CO with it looking perfect? And so a lot of your apartment complexes, your multifamily folks have figured this out. They obviously use commercial grade materials everywhere. But if you look at your nicer rental and leasing and condos, they'll finish them with a stone facade, they'll make sure that they got some nice plants and some amenities and it looks really cool. Well, they've taken the opposite approach, which I think, is pretty accurate. So when you're talking with your teams, you have to explain why you're doing things, what the expectation is, how it reflects on them, because again, they have to buy into it. And everyone wants to be viewed as valuable and a professional. And so if you can explain to them how to accomplish that, help them accomplish it, and then recognize it with random recognition, my experience is they will step up in a large number, certainly not all, but in a large number.
Yeah, you triggered quite a few things in that little segment there. And first was some reading that I had done through Daniel Kahneman. It was in his book, Thinking Fast and Slow. Maybe it was in his book, Noise. It was a follow-up. But what he talked about was a study, and they were doing a study of individuals in pain and people who are going in for medical procedures. And, you know, what the person's perception of the experience was after the procedure was complete. And what they found is, even though that the patient went through much higher pain through the procedure, if it finished with a low level of pain, then the person had a very positive recall of the procedure versus those who didn't have any pain for the majority of it. But if it finished with a high spike of pain, the person remembered it as being something very unpleasant. So you mentioned about that fit and finish. In reality, it's about how you finish that is going to leave that probably lasting impression. And all the things you did before that are probably less important. That then dovetail back into communication. And the fact that we can go into, whether it's this podcast, which is generally end-to-end and it's long form, about an hour, is probably less about the meat in the middle, but how we start and how we finish to ensure that in your communication, you've got to finish well. Right, you've got to go that last 6 feet. You've got to make that good throw and the good catch. Because if you do that at the end, then the audience, the crew, will be left with a very defined understanding of what the next step is or what the expectation is. But so often we're good in the beginning, we have a lot of energy, but as the communication goes, it starts to get watered down. And it's more important, I think, now to finish well than it is to begin well. Thoughts on that?
Well, we have the joy of technology, so they get to do shorts, so they can make
that's us, true. They yeah, can they make it look great. Yeah. Exactly.
So right. We can do that. Yeah. I think that what we have overgeneralized, which is why a lot of people confuse this, is the "what have you done for me lately?" And certainly that is a negative, I think somewhat appropriately negative phrase. But I do distinguish that between finishing well and fit and finish. So what? You know, I think that is a much more narrow, what have you done for me lately, is they don't give you credit for your previous performance. And so if you had done great fit and finish in the last 12 projects and you have a slip up on the 13th, they act like you've never done well. Well, that is wrong. But that is different than consistently, you know, doing 7 weeks of great work and then the 8th week you coast home and you don't finish the project. Well, that's what I would consider fit and finish. And so I do think that when they don't understand, things go wrong, people make mistakes, you know, your last performance is your only performance type of attitude. You know, in most contexts, I view that as very negative. Certainly, there are contexts where that's necessary, sports being one. If you can't win, it doesn't matter how good you were forever, because it's about winning.
It's true.
But when you talk about trying to perform a project at work or a project, you know, to produce something, consistency, Lean Six Sigma, which all that is very important, there's still going to be a failure at some point.
Yeah, you're right.
And so I think a lack of realization that nothing is perfect and we're all humans kind of rolls over into people pushing back against fit and finish. And it's like, no. If you focus on finishing well, looking like a professional, acting like a professional, people will start treating you like a professional. Your confidence will go up. Their trust will go up. Your relationship will go up. If they don't appreciate that over the long term, or they don't give grace when someone is sick or you do not, you know, hit the mark, then you start evaluating whether the person you want to partner with. But I think you have to communicate that topic as well, very consistently, and talk about the difference in aspirational goals and executing on what is actually assigned and the task to a high level. Those are not the same. And so I think we confuse some of those things as well.
You mentioned a great word there, consistency. And as you did that, it triggered in my mind another book that I read called The Five Frequency by a gentleman called Jeff Grimshaw. And in there, what he talks about in that book is that there are five frequencies, and it's important that you're consistent in your communication across those five frequencies. And the five frequencies are your actions and decisions. When you talk about your actions and decisions, are those consistent with what you reward and recognize, which is the second frequency? So there's got to be, you know, consistency between those two. And then the next frequency is what do you tolerate or what you don't tolerate, right? There's got to be a nice clean alignment between your decisions and your actions, what you reward and recognize, and what you tolerate and don't tolerate. And then the final two are how do you show up informally and how do you communicate formally? So whether someone sees you outside of the office environment, are you acting and are you speaking and are you emphasizing the same things in an informal environment as you are in your formal communication, whether that's in an email or an all hands or things of that nature. So that consistency of communication around those different frequencies helps deliver that message, right? And the person knows it's now congruent and true and not something simply you're saying to get them to do something, to manipulate them, or something you're saying because you're trying to present a happy face in the midst of adversity, or again, you're not showing the grace. But then that also led me into what you mentioned about grace and failure. And how we communicate during failure is so critically important, right? If we immediately come in as a leader and it's all about, you know, why did this happen? And it's a lot of you sort of statements, you know, why did you do this? Or how come you didn't check that? That's not going to go over very well. The person is then probably going to hide potential problems and failures because they don't want to be ridiculed. They don't want to be demeaned. They don't want to be called out. However, you can still hold people accountable by talking about failure in a positive sense. Okay, what can we learn from this? What can we do next time? What were you thinking in terms of your thought process? Help me understand that, because maybe you did everything right and just had a bad outcome, right? You went through the proper preparation. You did think about what the impact on the client or the customer was going to be. You did think about potential impact on employees. And even though you put all those things in place and you tried to mitigate the risk as you possibly could, bad things still happened. But if you came down hard, the person now doesn't have that consistency going back to the five frequencies that the decisions that they made, you know, we're wrong. When actually this decision cycle was fine. It's just the result wasn't what we wanted. What's been your experience in the, how do you communicate failure? How do you show grace? It's one of our values, grace through generosity. Why did you build that into the culture and what's your view towards failure?
Sometimes there's just brain fog and lockups, and those are just pure grace. And I don't think everyone's going to hit the mark every day. So, you know, that's the reality of that part. Set aside that 10% of the failures that are truly just a flub. And then we usually, I would like to say that I do it all the time. Of course, I don't. I try to take a step back and say, was the decision kind of matrix, the decision tree you went down, did that reflect our values? And so if you reflected our values in the decisions you made, and second to that, what I say all the time, control what you can control. So you controlled what you knew and you could do, and the outcome wasn't correct. We're pretty close to even celebrating that, because at the end of the day, we don't control a ton. No one controls near what they think they do. And so if you made decisions in alignment with the values, you controlled everything that was within your ability to control. And that doesn't mean you went on some great detailed search and research of everything in the world, but you took a reasonable effort, we would say, from the law side to control everything in control, and it just didn't fall your way. There's not even a reason to be angry, maybe disappointed, but there's no reason. It's not even a tremendous amount of grace if you do it properly. It is, you know what, Scott, you prepared well, you understood the situation, you accounted for all that we could think of, and it just didn't hit the mark. there's not even much reason to apologize. And the employee should not feel like they, mm-hmm. you should actually make them feel like they should not apologize. Because if they do that behavior every time, overwhelmingly, you're going to win. And so that's a big difference between that mistake and the one I started with, was just, you just, you know, in sports term or baseball term, you just booted it. You just screwed it up. You didn't do what you needed to do. You were late. Those types of things actually, to me, require more grace, because, you know, your trigger, you're ready to pull the trigger and make some decisions that are probably not too beneficial to their career. And sometimes you got to take the time and go, wait a minute. You know, they could have a sick kid, a sick wife. You don't.
Ooh, yeah.
And so, you know, it's easy to pull the trigger. We are not in the situation you obviously were brought up in, where someone is going to die. So, you know, people could lose their jobs. I do dislike, you know, some of the stoic opinions that, you know, everything is only what you think it is, or you make it out to be. Well, no, people who lose their jobs and can't pay their bills and their wife leaves them and their kids, you know, they're destitute. They do actually kill themselves and get depressed, and things do fall apart. So I don't want to go as some of them go, that, oh, and everything is not life and death. And it's, you need to understand, it's their career. And a lot of people's family depend on the person you're employing. And so it is a big deal, but it's not true life and death, as if someone is not covering, you know, their responsibility when you're going into battle or flying in a formation. That's a, you know, a lot less grace in that situation. So that one, I kind of went extremely, just messed it up,
mm-hmm.
to did all they could, and it didn't go well. And then there's that middle part that is, you're going to kind of flesh that out, see how important, how crucial was it. And that's an evaluation of downside risk, the yeah. chances of the downside risk, and the magnitude of the risk, which is, you know, a topic we won't get into. But I do think when you're communicating with your team, you should adjust and explain, maybe not in front of everyone, but maybe more in front of everyone, when it's a situation they acted within the values, they control what they controlled, and the chips just didn't fall where you wanted. That's probably a group discussion more than the other one is much more of the, you know, take them aside in private and ask them what the heck they were doing. And then that middle gray area, of course, is a little tougher call.
You mentioned a couple of minutes ago an apology, right? And it just so happens, I was reading an article this morning by McKinsey, and they brought up a situation that happened at Microsoft, and Satya Nadella, I think his name is properly, is, you know, actually came forth and said, I made a mistake. He had made a statement in public that suddenly caused a lot of problems internally because of what was said, and a lot of employees were upset. And he actually called a meeting, you know, a company-wide meeting, and apologized and said, look, I spoke wrong, right? Or I made this particular mistake. We don't see that very often, right? We all tend to see ourselves as leaders as being, you know, almost perfect, right? Not very often do you bring the organization together to admit that you made a mistake. But admitting that mistake, going back to your grace, just says, look, it happens. That's part of the things that we got to deal with in a business environment. You also mentioned something that recalled in my mind, you know, the Stephen Covey habit of seek first to understand, then to be understood. And that's an important thing. I know that in my career, there were many times that I came in because I was a fix-it guy. And if something wasn't to parameter, I was immediately on it. And that created an almost adversarial relationship between me and my project managers. And I have to admit that many times I got it wrong, right? If I would have just taken a moment to ask, help me understand why we are where we are, instead of hammering them because we weren't on schedule, my relationship with them would have been much better. But more importantly, it would have taken away a lot of the friction and helped things get performed better, faster, more consistently, et cetera. And so what that reminded me of is this reaction, instead of responding, reacting to a situation, and that comes into the communication. And for me, what I have to be very, very aware of is my tone. Because I come from military background, I can speak very authoritatively. And that turns people off and makes people defensive. It's not really what I mean. It's just how I come across. And I really have to temper that. You've seen it a couple of times in our interactions. And so, you know, as a CEO of a family of companies, how do you keep your tone in check, right? Especially knowing that others can be triggered by it. Have you struggled with that? You tend to be kind of a calm, cool, and collected guy, but I'm sure something can get under your skin.
Yeah, I usually stay calm and cool because the switch on the other side is not so good.
Not so good? Okay.
I grew up young with a temper, so I was much more of an emotional person. So that definitely, to your point, does not go over well when you're unpredictable and you go too far. You know, I think that to your point, two things you do when you go too far that really come to mind at first, two big ones to me is one, even if you don't, if you push back as a leader against feeling like you're warm and fuzzy and being soft or whatever you perceive because you want to be show that you're tough as a female leader in a man's world, or you're a man and you're going to try to show everybody else how you're the alpha, either one of those, realize that one of our values in it is to innovate, to elevate. So your point on creating fear and unwillingness to explore and to be creative, you're going to crush that. And two, you're either arrogant or ignorant, maybe both.
Maybe both.
because you assume that you know all the parameters and all the things that went into that mistake if you don't approach it in a way that Covey mentioned, because you assume that they did it wrong, period, because you know the right way. And so that means you assume you know all the technical and the SLA and the SOW,
right.
You also know the temperament of the team, the situation, sort of to your military terms, how it was on the ground. Sounds real good when you're in Tampa or wherever now.
Right, yeah,
talking to people in Afghanistan. Well, you're not on the ground.
That's right.
And you don't know the morale of your team. You don't know actually whether they're going to follow at this moment, whether they're tired. You can't tell. And so I think another way is to, one, you're going to stifle innovation, and two, a little self-reflection on the leader of, you know what, that's extremely arrogant and extremely ignorant for you to presume, that you know all possible parameters that are going into that decision that turned out to be an outcome you didn't like. And it may just be a flub, but you don't know why they screwed it up. And if you have an assumption that everyone's life and everyone is going to perform at an A-plus level every day, then you're back to the ignorant part. And so I just don't think that's realistic. But there are certainly times you and I have talked about where you must show the team that there are consequences. And I do think that we have pivoted, and you and I have had this discussion, and I'm certainly in the camp that praise publicly, criticize privately. We talked about that. We talked about that when it is a mistake that actually we want to somewhat celebrate, because at all things right, the outcome didn't go. I think you should be willing to do that much more publicly. And then occasionally when it is a disregard of the values or disregard of the team, how do you handle that? And certainly there's HR laws and all that stuff. But, in my experience, one or two clear, decisive responses to people who act contrary to the culture, contrary to the team and the company and the crew, as we're using the metaphor of the ship. There are some very famous stories of what happened on the cruise.
That's
when
right.
You went against the crews.
That's
and there's
right.
a reason yeah. for the reason, the reason for them walking the plank, and a reason for Sir Francis Drake executing, beheading his friend going around the tip of South America, because everything was going to get lost. Again, we're not life or death like that, but there is a time to me when, that was so contrary to what we stand for and against you as the employees and the company and our vision. They're gone right now. In front of everyone. And that's a controversial position, and certainly not a card you should pull out very often, but I think it is naive, because if your team really cares, they're waiting on you to have their back. And if you don't have their back, then you're losing just as much trust as trying to build the culture and the communication and everything else. When they know the leader is 100% usurping what you are trying to build and what they're trying to accomplish, and you don't display that you have their back, that's where you lose it by the bucket.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you were speaking there, I was thinking about all the things we've talked about so far in this podcast. And because some of the examples you were just giving, you know, are pretty extreme, and they can be pretty jarring to the people observing it or the people enduring it, whatever word you want to use. However, if you have been consistent in your communication, if you have set the expectations, we talked about fit and finish, right? And you know that that's our standard, then a deviation from the standard shouldn't be as shocking to those who know, because they know the standard. And so they should be able to tie it to that, wait a minute, this makes sense in terms of the frequency of communication, aligning and all those different steps, what you tolerate and what you don't tolerate. It comes into that area. And so while it can seem those are extreme situations and that, you know, that can be very disruptive toward an organization and that's not how a leader should be, and people can make all kinds of judgments towards it, the bottom line is, have you been consistent in your communication? Have you set the standard? Have you ensured that the people understand that you care for them and that this particular action is simply being consistent with our culture? I think you have a much better outcome, because it sets as an example and people go, yeah, in fact, it would have been uncharacteristic. In fact, you could have eroded communication and culture if you didn't do it. Right.
Well,
you're like, wait a minute,
you
said this is what we stood for, yet this person crossed the line. You did nothing. Sort of drawing the old red lines in the political view.
I think that for those that are very sensitive and think that it is inappropriate to ever publicly defend your team, I would consider that you often, the same individual, say we should treat our company and our employees as our family. So let's take it to how you would handle your family in your home. So if they're truly your family and someone is doing something contrary to hurt your family and family members, how would you respond?
Yeah.
And so if you are consistent, you show compassion, you're clear in the culture, clear in the expectations, this is not one erratic and it's not unhinged to something that's clearly contrary to the well-being of the organization and the employees, then I certainly think you're eroding a ton of trust, because you have said you're for them. You said we're in it together. You said that you're going to have them as a family and that we should all take ownership. And you've said all the things that are actually appropriate and the right way to lead. But when the rubber hit the road and it was time to protect them.
Yes. Yes.
You hid under the, let's give this one more chance. And so that's what you would tolerate when you're talking about the five frequencies. Is there are occasions where, and I think it is extremely naive as a leader to think there are not going to be occasions where one action can be detrimental or risky enough to the success of the whole organization, which means the employees, that you have to give a demonstration of this is out of bounds and something must happen right now and everyone needs to be clear. That's too far. You cross the line.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, and that's the reason they did it. That's why captains, when you go back to our metaphor, when it was attempted mutiny, that was death. It was not a small thing. And that was not because they love running around. They need, obviously, on a mission, a voyage around, you know, Sir Francis Drake, when he's going, you know, off of the coast of Africa, and it was a secret mission. He's got to keep his crew rallied. He's got a couple of boats. They're going around the tip of South America, and actually, I guess, through the straits there before they got to the tip, but Magellan Straits, I believe it's called. And he has to execute. That's not because he didn't need crew members, and he didn't need someone leading the other team. So he certainly didn't want to lose valuable people, because it's not like you can go online and put a career builder's ad when you're, you know, a thousand miles in the middle of nowhere.
So up,
when you make the decision to have to get rid of someone, in that case, literally, that's detrimental potentially to the crew, to the whole mission, but it's more detrimental to show the crew you're not going to back them, hold them accountable, and live out what you said you're going to live out. Again, that's sailing and that's military. This is business, but there's still times in business where they are doing things that undermine your largest client. They're doing things that are undermining an initiative you're trying to run out that you believe and have discussed as best for the employees in the organization, or they're trying to steal people that work for you and put in, or move accounts or moonlighting and different types of construction. Mm-hmm. those things are directly contrary to the health and well-being of the business and the employees. And if you claim to care, what are you going to do about it? And I think failing to do something about it says a lot more than you'll communicate in all the meetings we discussed earlier.
Right.
And so the communication, again, is not lived out. It goes into what you tolerate, and I think you're going to have an issue. So that's my long answer to those. I think that's over the top. I do think it should be rare. I do think it can't be erratic. I do think it can't be unhinged to a clear explanation of why you're doing it.
Right.
As far as you can clearly explain it, which we know from labor law and HR is pretty hard to explain most of the time. But you know, even if you can explain it, the employees that care, if you built a rapport, they and you are not erratic in your behavior, they go, oh my gosh, that must have been enough to justify a big change and an immediate change. And so when we talk about, you know, an immediate termination that's pretty public that everyone knows about, you better have laid the capital with your teams.
That's right. Right.
Trust capital, relationship capital, been clear on the expectations, clear on that. Sometimes, unfortunately, most of the time, because of labor law, you can't explain clearly why you made the decision,
Correct.
Which is, you know, I see as a very tough thing for leaders in some organizations. Business probably a little easier. I see it in charity and churches and nonprofits as a much harder. You see folks get let go and they, you know, everyone is in an uproar. How could you do this?
Yes, you know, you're
horrible. They were the greatest person ever. Well, you know, unfortunately, those that are listening that run business understand you actually can't even legally defend yourself. So they're out there saying, how could you let Scott go? He's the greatest person ever, and my kids loved him, and he did all this for the community. And you can't say, well, Scott actually was doing X, Y, Z, and so he had to go immediately.
Yes.
You don't get the benefit of doing that. So I think that that's important for a leader to know. It's obviously common. There's a good discussion on the, you know, what is it? The problem with conjecture. And I think that that is you're predicting the future and you can't actually prove the future. So you're doing what you think is in the best interest. And then on top of that, you know, can't explain it. So that's a pretty hard thing to do. But you need to have communicated beforehand, built the rapport, and again, be consistent in how you behave so that when it is an anomaly,
right,
it's not just erratic. They know something happened.
Exactly. So as we head towards wrapping up, Chandler, you know, we talked a lot about direct communication. It's the captain communicating directly with the crew. We talked about this importance of alignment and making sure that when something does happen in an extreme side of things, that it makes sense to them. You know, you've now had the ability to have other leaders of your families of companies. And so how does it change in the communication, almost in a cascading situation? Is your communication to your senior leaders different than it would be you directly to your crew? And then what are the expectations from a communication standpoint on cascading your direction, culture down to others? Does that complicate things? What have maybe some things that you found worked out well?
It is not complicated for me, because even at 29 walking, I always had the opinion that it was very rare for me to direct someone else's team. And so even if I came in and took note of things that weren't in alignment, they weren't exactly the way we wanted it, I would circle up with that leader, talk with that leader, and have that leader continue to keep their rapport, because I do not want to usurp them. So I want it to look like, and I even would talk to them about, hey, don't just change tomorrow so it looks like the boss came in and, you know, fixed it.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, start implementing some things here. Here's some things, and these got to be fixed. But I rarely would walk in, take the reins. And so as the companies grew, and now we have multiple companies and other presidents, they run them the way they run them. We just require, you know, their why to have alignment with the Rosewood why, their values to be the same values as Rosewood. So the values don't really get to change. But the reality is, when we want to control all these meetings and dictate how it gets done, there is another side of it, is where messiness manifests still in excellence. And so if you're going to have true diverse people with diverse backgrounds, diverse ways they want to do it, the idea you're going to control it and dictate it, I think you can dictate the values again. You can dictate the fit and finish and the finished product dictating how they arrive there. Of course, this is this is different than technical things. So there's technical things that must be done in an order, but you know, they may not lead the way you do. They may not market the way you market. They may not build relationships the way you build relationships. That doesn't mean they're not successful. And so you've got to just kind of do that zoom in and zoom out. It is different because you want to, you certainly are itching to impose your will and your style. But it's sort of, if you're more on the white collar office side, to me, it's like asking people to review something you've written. And so they can review something you've written and they can tell you when grammatically it's wrong or spelling or maybe a format of how you did it. But when they start swapping out words.
Yes. Yes.
Now they're not reviewing. They're actually trying to make it sound like themselves. And so if you kind of take that as an analogy directly to your, you know, there's things we can't do that are contrary to the amalgamation of all the books you've read. They're in psychological studies after studies. We know it's bad for influence and team building. Unacceptable. Those are kind of like, to me, looking at grammar, looking at spelling, looking at maybe the way you structured the order of things. When you start telling them what to say and when to say it and how exactly to say it, now you're kind of imposing your words into their writing, and I think you've gone way too far. And so I kind of take that as the line that's not always bright, but it is a line that's there.
Yeah, and I'm aligned with that, right? I'm okay with someone telling me what they want done. Don't tell me how to do it, right? That's kind of why you have me and my knowledge, experience, et cetera, is to get those things done. But you also mentioned something, it goes back to our consistency theme a little bit earlier, which as you're cascading information down, especially as it comes from the top, and they're very important things that you want to ensure that everyone gets in the same tone or the same clarity, is the use of talking points. Right. Look, you can disseminate this information if you want, but this has to be the message that you deliver. Right. This has to be the pieces that you lay out in this particular order. It is kind of bridging that divide between being prescriptive and descriptive, but you can't afford someone to play the game of telephone that a message that you gave at the senior level of the organization, and as it works its way down to the rank and file employee, suddenly it's come something completely different. And I think talking points and that effective cascading of communication is a way in which you can ensure consistency of information that gets on down. Because I've been the recipient, and I've also been the person who has given direction only to find out it wasn't delivered in the way that I had intended. And it caused problems only because I didn't use some mechanism to say, this is the consistency of information that needs to be communicated. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, we talked about whyology on here a few times. The way we view that is, you know, Simon Sinek does a great job and others of discovering your why, what do you do with it afterwards. And so we had a debate at one of our cohorts, and I think that I went and looked the words up, and so it gets a little nerdy, but I said you decompose it down to the lowest level employee.
Yes.
And it was a discussion whether it's decompose or deconstruct. And so decompose is usually viewed more as breaking down matter and kind of a, you know, rotting. So deconstruct is actually to break it into its individual parts. And so to make it broken down to where they understand what you're saying, which is much more in your talking points. So,
right.
All right. Well, I'm going to have a message. I need to be aware of who's receiving it, and I need to break it down myself manually to each level. On the other side, when we talk about explaining your purpose, our why, on the upside, I do switch back over now to compose, because compose means you bring together all their varying abilities. So when we roll it back up, I don't want to construct it, which would be very prescriptive. I'd be telling you, so I'll deconstruct it down, and we will not construct it back up. We will compose it, because I want you or Jay and Antonio and marketing, and I want their way, because I need their unique vision of how to build it back, and then just be clear on what I want the finished product to be, because I started with the finished product before I deconstructed it. But Composed means they get to be a little more unique. They bring their abilities to play their instruments, if you think of a symphony or an orchestra.
Right.
But they know the song we're playing, but, you know, and there's a lot more detail and obviously an orchestra. But in the world of business, you don't get to control it like you do music. So I need you, when you see a problem, I need you to solve it the Scott way. And I need, you know, employee X to do it their way. They know where we're trying to go to your point, because the talking point's broken.
Right.
And then you be real careful not to become a dictator of how to build it up. And usually the conflict is in between those. I let you compose it. It doesn't turn out the way it should. The conflict exists when I say, well, why did you do that? And to your point, it's a, why did you? And
then immediately exactly. You're starting
to go at it. So how you approach that, we won't get into today. But so, looking at the words, that's what came to mind. You certainly want to deconstruct, so break down those talking points to the levels you're communicating to, but you want to give some freedom of how they execute on what you've clearly explained. So.
Well, and that's why we call it the art of communication. It's not a science. There's a little bit of grayness on either side, a little bit of individual personality that goes into it. So we'll wrap it up there. Perhaps a couple of things I want to emphasize through this whole conversation is that need for consistency. We talked about those five frequencies, everything from your actions and decisions to what you reward and recognize to what you tolerate and don't tolerate. How do you show up informally and how do you show up formally? The importance of that face-to-face communication to really ensure people understand what's going on. The use of identifying your influencers or your key personnel who now serve as your representatives who are communicating the information the way that you want. And also we talked about sort of the four types of meetings. You got an informational meeting, you got an alignment meeting, you got a decision meeting, and a brainstorming meeting. So, you know, why you're getting together, what is the purpose of it, and what are the messages you want them to leave with, I think are very, very important. Anything you want to emphasize?
Just pounding home the ultimate goal and the way you want to go about it through the values and what you consider excellence and fit and finish, I think are important, because that, you know, starts the conversation. Obviously looking to understand, we talked about quite a bit, seeking to understand. Mm-hmm. That's a big part. Also the consistency in building up your capital with the team that you lead. And so, you know, view it as a bank account. If you don't have a bunch of deposits, you can't make a bunch of withdrawals. And so if you have not poured into them when you go to ask them to do something, or when you have to correct them and you do not have the trust and you haven't built the rapport, the odds of it becoming combative and not going well are much higher. And so, and then ultimately when you have to make some of those hard decisions that are gonna of course be public, you know, you don't have the capital where they assume you did it in their best interest. They may assume the opposite, that you're just a horrible boss.
Right. And so, That's true. Okay, let's bring the ship into port. We want to thank everyone for listening or watching The Powerhouse Perspective, and join us next time. Until then, cheers.